Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Economics 101, right after this. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper are things like stocks and bonds and Federal Reserve notes and credit cards and debt and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or commercial currency. And you know, that's pretty true when you're dealing with banks and government and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper money, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money in place of gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason. They knew, and they knew full well when they did it back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin, so that they could take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. So if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we're going to have to, first of all, regain our property and our property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me show you how to do just that. It's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first? That's the place to start. Doesn't cost anything. Maybe this isn't for you. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and then it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, when you go to our website, if you'll go to our archives page, you can download that free general law CD package directly off of our internet connection. That's georgegordon.org. Hey, my wife went over to the health food store the other day, and she came back and gave me a report. While she was there in the health food store buying a few things, the lady that owns the health food store, who we're fairly well acquainted with, we buy there quite often, she asked my wife what she thought devaluation meant. So my wife told her that devaluation occurs when governments go broke. When they can't pay their debts, they print the money and devalue their currency. We've been going through a devaluation, commonly known as inflation, since 1933 here in the United States. And if you take a look at prices, wages, costs, taxes in 1933 and compare them to today, you'll see that we have now lost 98% of the value of the dollar. So we're not talking about devaluation in the immediate term. as being the wipeout of the value of your money, we've already experienced that. That's already happened. It's past tense. So you don't need to be concerned about 98 cents on the dollar of devaluation because you've already lived through that. Put another way, if you had a $20 gold piece and a $20 bill, you know, one of those $20 Federal Reserve note bills, and you put it in the top drawer of your dresser in 1933, and then today you go to your top drawer dresser and you take out the gold piece and the $20 bill, and you want to go out and spend them. So first of all, you take the $20 gold piece down to Charlie at the gold store, and you put it on the counter, and he'll pay you out something like, oh, I don't know, $1,050, $1,100, something on that order, and then you can go shopping. If you take your $20 bill, you just take it into the store and put it on the counter and go shopping, it'll buy you about one necktie, but the gold coin today would buy you approximately a Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, socks, suspenders, shirt, underwear. I mean, you get the whole outfit and have change left over. Now, in 1933, if you had taken your $20 bill into John's suit shop, it wouldn't have made any difference whether you gave him the $20 gold piece or the $20 bill. You could have bought a Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, suspenders, shoes, shirt, underwear, everything, and had change left over and walked out. So what's happened is a giant devaluation of about 98% over the last 80 years. That's the reality of it. All right, now, what we're facing today is a rapid devaluation of the last 2 cents. In other words, you got a dollar bill in your pocket, and you know about what that's going to buy. Doesn't buy very much, but it buys a little something. And so if you've got a $20 bill in your pocket, you could come up with a, you know, a picture in your mind is about what that's going to buy. You know, when you walk into the coffee shop or the donut store, you know, how many donuts are you going to get for your $20 bill? Now, what this lady was angling toward is there a devaluation coming? And if so, how bad is it going to be? Well, back in the late 1990s over in Russia, they had a devaluation. And in the United States, we had a devaluation in March of 1933. In 1783, we had a devaluation here in the United States. These devaluations occur from time to time. The Argentines had it in 2002. It has occurred in Germany in 1924. These devaluations, hyperinflations and so on, or revaluations of gold and so on. Brazil went through a revaluation or a devaluation, depending upon how you want to word it, back in the 1980s. Now, when these occur, some pretty drastic results come about. For instance, in Russia, let's suppose you had 1,000 rubles in the bank. Now, whatever a ruble would buy on Friday, when the devaluation occurred, it always occurs over a weekend, so it'll occur between Friday and Monday. And the bank will inform you, or the government will inform you by way of radio and television, that there's a revaluation going on, and you're to take all of your old rubles, you know, maybe they're printed in blue, and trade them in for the new ruble on Monday, which is now in red, and they give you a certain amount of time to do that. No, they'll give you 30 days to trade in your old rubles for the new rubles. And then if you do that, they'll give you a certain percentage of the old ruble. So you take your old rubles in, let's take in 100, and they will give you 10 of the new rubles. Now, this is a bad deal for you, because the prices out there in the grocery stores don't change between Friday and Monday. So you've just taken a 90% hit on the amount of money that you had in the bank or that you have in your pocket. Now, this is what the world is getting ready for. It's a rapid devaluation of the last 2 pennies of the purchasing power of your 1933 dollar. and you're likely to lose somewhere in the neighborhood of 90%. In 1783, that there was a devaluation, there was a collapse of the continental currency. They called it the continental currency, and there was a collapse of it. Between 1754 and 1783, the average loss to the average Joe Sixpack who dealt in those commercial papers, those commercial currencies, those dollars of commercial or continental money, lost 90% of their purchasing power over that period of time. So, by comparison, today we haven't done too much worse than that. It's 98%. You know, it's in the same neighborhood. Now, if you take a look at the value of the last 2 cents that you've got, see, you're not thinking of these dollar bills as being 2 pennies. You're thinking of them as being 100 cents on the dollar. And the deception with inflation comes like this. If you were to ask the average Joe Sixpack, are you better off today than you were 50 years ago? He would say, oh, my God, yeah, much better off, much better off. Because back 50 years ago, I was making $2 an hour, and today I'm making $20 an hour. So I'm making 10 times more money. Now, what this guy doesn't seem to grasp, and this is the average Joe Sixpack now I'm talking about, and I talk to people, you know, pretty regularly, they don't understand the loss that occurs in the purchasing power. So let me give you a little example of how that works. In 1950, if you went in to buy a gallon of gasoline, you would have paid about 27.5 cents a gallon. That's the average price of gas in 1950. In 1950, the average wage was about $1.75 an hour. So for your $1.75, for your 1 hour's labor, you'd get 1.75 cents divided by 27.5. So you would get 6 gallons of gas. A little over, but around 6 gallons of gas for an hour's work. Now, the last time I was at the gas station here where I'm at, we're getting $2.50 a gallon gas. Now we're making around $20 an hour. It's actually, I think, the national average is $17.58, but let's just plug in $20, shall we? And let's divide that by $2.50. And then today you get 8 gallons of gas for an hour's work. So if you compare the price of gasoline today with the price of gasoline in 1950 and its relationship to your labor and your purchasing power, gasoline today is cheaper by 25% than it was in 1950. So if you're making $20 an hour today, doing whatever you're doing, and you're buying gas at $2.50 a gallon, you've got 25% more gasoline for your 1 hour's labor. Boy, that's really good. Same thing is applicable to computers and to talk on the telephone. You know, your telephone bill is less. Now, food and various other things, automobiles, I can remember in 1950, an automobile cost about $1,600. $1,600 to buy an automobile. You know, a new Ford, new Chevrolet, something like that. Now, today, you buy a new Ford, new Chevrolet, depends on what you buy, of course, but it's around $20,000. So they've gone up from $1,600 to $16,000 to $20,000. So they're up by about 10 times. As a general rule, you can just apply 10 to the number. If you're making 10 times more money than you were in 1950, well, then you're probably just about on point. The other day, I've used this example a few times. My granddad, when I was a kid, making $1.75 an hour, this is back, you know, in 1950, he would give me a dime, just 10 cents. And then I'd go down to the ice cream store, and I could get a double-decker chocolate ice cream cone for a dime. Well, the other day I went into TCBY and it was $2.35. So $2.35 today, and $17.50 being the national average, I'm going to get about, let's just try this out, $17.50 divided by $2.35. I get 7.5 ice cream cones. Now in 1945 to 50, I'd get 17 ice cream cones. $1.75, at 17 and a half ice cream cones. Today I get 7 and a half. I've lost 10 ice cream cones. Now, if you take a look at automobiles and the various other things that we were buying back in those days, and you compare them with purchasing power, there's been a devaluation. But the devaluation came over a long period of time. And so most of you people don't even remember 1950. Hell, you weren't even born then. So 1950 isn't the date that you're gonna apply any economics to. But what's happened over the years, and it doesn't make any difference where you start, the purchasing power of your money has been going down. In 1980, for instance, if you can remember back that far, the purchasing power of a dollar was X. Then in 2000, if you took a look at the purchasing power of the dollar in 2000 compared to 1980, it had depreciated by half. Prices doubled between 1980 and 2000. In a 20-year period, prices doubled. So they went up roughly 5% a year. Not compounded, but 5% a year for 20 years. Then between 2000 and 2007, the value of the dollar depreciated by 30%. 30% in 7 years. 50% in 20 years and 30% in 7. So the destruction of your purchasing power is accelerating. And now your government is printing money faster, and they're taking on debt faster, and they're inflating the currency faster. So my guess would be that between 2007 and 2014, that's a 7-year period, I think that the purchasing power of the dollar measured in 2007 terms will probably depreciate by about 50%. Something faster than it did in the 7 years between 2000 and 2007. Now that's a devaluation. But it's a slow devaluation over a long period of time. The rapid devaluation that occurs in a crisis like we saw in Russia and Argentina in the late 1990s, 95, 96, 97 in Russia, and then 2002 in Argentina, it occurs over the weekend. And that's what we're facing here in the United States, is a devaluation over the weekend. And when that comes, whatever money you have in the bank, let's say that you've got your 401k in the bank and you have $100,000 in the bank, and there's a 50% devaluation over the weekend, then the purchasing power of your money in the bank, your 401k that you're hoping to buy your Winnebago with and travel around America when you retire, is going to be cut in half, 50%. When my wife pointed this out, the lady in the health food store said, "That isn't fair." When my wife reported that we were eating dinner, and I said, "That woman in the health food store has her head right up her rectum region, doesn't she? I mean, that woman doesn't know whether her ass is bored or punched. That's the bottom line." And the tragedy of all of this is that woman votes. That ought to just scare the living hell out of you. You know, if you stop and think about that for a minute. That woman is going to vote for President of the United States. She's going to vote for the Senate and House of Representatives coming up this fall. And that woman doesn't have a very good understanding of economics. She was born here. She went to school here. She probably went to college. She's a businesswoman. I mean, my God, she owns a business. She's a small business owner. And God love her. We all like her. But the ignorance that we Americans share in economics is deplorable. I mean, just, it's pathetic. So I thought, let's take a look at economics from a different perspective. Instead of watching the Lehrer News Hour and Paul Tsongas come on. Now, Paul's a nice guy. Gotta love him. Don't you? I mean, he's such a friendly sort of a fellow, and he interviews people on the PBS NewsHour, and he's their economics correspondent. Now, Paul is as dumb as a box of rocks. I mean, that guy couldn't carry guts to a barrel when we're talking about money. But he acts like he can. He talks like he can. He's about 60 to 65 years old, balding, and he's probably got a degree from college, and he's working every day, and he's got a Social Security number and a 401, and you know he's looking forward to retirement. And he is viewing the world just like you and I are. When we watch the CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, and God love her, you know, everybody loves Katie, but she's just as dumb as a box of rocks. And I'm sorry to say that, but that's just where reality's at. Now, I picked up a book here the other day. Actually, it was my son. He was happened to be in Springfield the other day, and he was in Barnes & Noble, and as his habit is, he goes in there and he buys books. He came back with a big stack of books, about 10 or 15 books, and one of them caught my eye. It's called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Now, Henry Hazlitt is one of these conservative writers, economics writers. You know, one of these right-wing radical reactionary from the far right. You know, one of these lunatic fringers over here. Well, back in 1946, he wrote a book called Economics in One Lesson. Fairly simple. It's written on a layman's level, you know, so plumbers like me can read it and understand it. And it has a very simple, straightforward presentation. And then here's what it is. There's no free lunch, and you can't get something for nothing. It's just that simple. No big deal. No free lunch, and you can't get something for nothing. Now, in every con game, whether it's Social Security or the bailout of the banks or the TARP program or it's jobs, whatever it is the politician's trying to sell this week, he's trying to sell you something for nothing. Unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, national health care insurance. What these programs are, in the final analysis, they're offering you something for nothing. They're offering you a free lunch, and that's what you want to hear, and that's what you want to buy. And it works, and I'm not here to argue with you about how well it works and about how many people subscribe to it. And hell, the majority of Americans, hell, the majority of the people in the world subscribe to these philosophical economic ideas espoused by people like Franklin D. Roosevelt and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and Henry Paulson. And it doesn't make any difference what political party you belong to. I'm not sitting here picking on Republicans or Democrats or conservatives or liberals. I mean, everybody went to public school buys into this. So Henry Hazlitt took a look at it and said, but it doesn't work. That's what the bottom line is, doesn't work. And so the question arises, well, then what does work? Is there an economic system that has ever been used in the world that works? And the answer is yeah. It's called gold and silver coin. Gold and silver coin, just weights and balances. It was first introduced in Western Anglo-Saxon administration, or in legal administration, at Mount Sinai with Moses in 1329 B.C. That's the first time we got a glimpse of the economic system that was unveiled by the creator of the universe. Now, it takes many forms, and many people have many names and labels for it. We call it capitalism here, or it's called supply and demand, or it's called the free marketplace, or free market economics. There's various names and labels, you know, that people hang on it. In its final analysis, it devolves upon a very simple concept. You can never consume more than you produce. That's what the free market's all about. You cannot consume more than you produce. Now, you people all know that in our society today, there are all kinds of people out there consuming more than they produce. Everybody on welfare is consuming more than he produces. Because he's producing nothing and he's consuming. The policeman out there on the street is producing nothing. But he's consuming. He lives in a house. He goes to the grocery store and buys coffee. You know, He walks into the Winchell Donut Shop just like I do and orders up Winchell Donuts and coffee and gives people money and walks out of there. Now, you know, you've got all these people in the Army. They're producing nothing, and they're consuming much. In fact, in the United States of America, here's a number for you, all you people out there in the world. Here, listen to this. We have 300 million people in this country, and 151 million of them receive some form of public assistance. They receive a government check. They're getting paid something in some amount by some government agency. Now, 149 million people aren't getting anything from the government. They are net payers. They're called taxpayers. They're the people that are paying it in. So, now, and you know, all you bureaucrats and policemen, firemen out there, and well, we produce, and you know, we're taxpayers, you know. Nobody that works for the government has ever paid a nickel's worth of tax or is ever going to. Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. A guy that's receiving tax dollars isn't paying them. Let's take a look at this and think about it for a minute. Here's a fireman over here, and he's getting paid $1,000 a week. And out of his $1,000 a week, he has to pay $250 in taxes. And he says, see, I'm a taxpayer. I pay $250 a week in taxes. And where'd you get the $250, Tom? Well, I got it out of my check. And where'd your check come from? Well, it came from the taxpayers. So you got some plumbers and carpenters and farmers, and they're out here mining in the ground and building houses, and they're producing things and creating wealth. And this is what we're dealing with here in economics. It's the creation of wealth. And there's only four places that wealth can be created. Four places. And here's what they are. Get your pen and paper out here. We're going to talk about them. The first place that you create wealth is by farming. You get it out of the ground. Now write this down because it's very important. It's very important. This is the whole heart of economics. And that is all wealth comes out of the ground. All wealth comes out of the ground. If it didn't come out of the ground, you ain't got it. All right, now let's take a look at this. Put number 17 down here. I'm going to write down all wealth, so I don't repeat this, comes out of the ground. Now, we can take this out of the ground in the form of mining, farming, fishing. There's one more here. Let me write that down. Mining, fishing, and farming. There's one more here. I'll think of it here in a minute. Just be patient with me. I'm old. Now, in order for us to get this wealth out of the ground, we got to go fishing. So we can throw our hook in the water, we can cast our nets out in the oceans, and we can bring in fish. Now, when a fisherman brings in a boatload of fish, he's actually bringing in new wealth. It's something that's never been there before. He's bringing in something here. When the forestry, that was the other one over here. You got mining, fishing, farming, and forestry. When the logger goes out in the woods and he cuts down a tree and he loads it on a truck, hauls it in, cuts it into boards and sends it over to Home Depot, he's creating new wealth. That new wealth is in the form of boards, lumber. When the miner goes out and he digs gold out of the ground, he's creating new wealth. It's new wealth coming out of the ground. When the farmer plants corn, and in the fall, harvest that corn, we got new wealth. And except for those four sources there, boys and girls, you ain't getting it from no place else. All wealth comes out of the ground. And the way we get a hold of it is we got to have miners, fishermen, farmers, and forestry people, loggers, to go out and bring that stuff in. Now, the carpenter comes along. See, now he works on those boards. He's actually creating wealth in the form of taking the boards and making a house. The miner over here, he's actually doing something. He's bringing aluminum out of the ground, or steel out of the ground, or coal out of the ground, and we're using that coal to make steel, to build houses and office buildings and to build bridges and to do things with. So there are people who are actually workers in our economy who actually produce all of the things that you and I enjoy in life. You know, the policeman goes into Winchell's. Well, the guy at Winchell's, you know, took the flour and made the donuts. Well, where did he get the flour? He got the flour, you know, from the miller. Where'd the miller get it? He got it from the broker. Where'd the broker get it? Got it from the farmer. Where'd he get it? Well, the farmer had to go out and produce it. He planted the seeds and grew the wheat. And there's this train that goes along in our economy, in our society. There are producers in the society. Now, everybody is a consumer. I'm a consumer. You are a consumer. But not every consumer is a producer. And that's where the rub comes in. Because all men are filled with vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And those are the motivators. Those are the things that motivate us to action. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Now, I'm not saying we don't need policemen. You know, beehives need guard bees. And so we need a few policemen out there. And we probably even need a few firemen out there to put fires out and keep our houses from burning down. And I'm not denying that. But when you firemen and policemen out there sit there and say, I'm a producer. No, you're a consumer, but you're not a producer. But you're a necessary liability. So there are some liabilities that we all have to have. In order to have an economy, we have to have government. Government is necessary, and I'm not sitting here as an anarchist telling you we should abolish government. Those of us that are the producers, you see, if we didn't have policemen out there, if we didn't have some guard bees, we would have a bunch of bad guys coming out there and stealing our productivity. They would be breaking the windows in our shops and stores and stealing the stuff out of our stores. So I need the policeman. I'm not denying that, Mr. Policeman. I just wanted to point out to you that you're not a producer. You're a consumer. I'm not a producer. You're a necessary liability. You're a liability to me, and I need you. Now, how many of these liabilities can we support? Because, you know, in a beehive, we have to have some drone bees. We don't deny that. But the bees don't produce 50% drones and 50% queens, because if they did, they wouldn't have a productive hive. In order to be productive, you have to have a division of labor. So in a beehive, we have a division of labor, and everybody's got a job to do, and everybody does his job, and they do it in balance. Get too many drones, we kill off a bunch of them. Now, in society, in a productive economy, what we need to do is we need to change some of these policemen and firemen and some of these drones that we have in society and get those people to producing again. Get them out there to where 51% of us are actually not consuming off of the taxpayer. That could probably be done with about 10 or 15%, not 51%. Because at some point in time, you're going to go over that trip wire. You're going to go over that balance beam. And when this thing gets too far out of balance, it's going to collapse then of its own weight. Now, that's what we're in the process of witnessing right now. We've crossed over that trip wire. We've gone over that balance beam. And now the world's economy is imploding right in front of our eyeballs. So you and I need to understand what caused that and what do we do to avoid getting swallowed up in it. Hey, we're at about the halfway point here, so let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Then click onto the archives page, and you can download that free introductory CD package right there online. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, and they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about Economics 101, and then we're going to review a book here called Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. Henry Hazlitt wrote this book back in 1946. It's about a 1 in 20 book. A lot of times people will call me and say, what do you mean by a 1 in 100 or a 1 in 20? Well, we read and review a lot of books here at the law school, and a 1 in 20 book means that there's other authors out there that have written books like this that can be just as good as or maybe better than this book. But this is a good one, and it's a story that you're going to read 20 books. You know, in round numbers, you'll read about 20 books, and then you'll find a little gem like this one. A 1 in 100 is so rare that you may never have heard this story in your life, and without this book, you probably will never hear the story. Dead Men Tell Tales is one of those 1 in 100 books. There may be one or two or three more out there, but they're not very common. And books that are written, as Solomon once made an observation in the scripture, he said, of the writing of books, there is no end. And boys and girls, we read a lot of books here, and I'm telling you, most of them aren't worth the time that it takes to read them, but you got to spend the time in order to get the material out of it. So you read 20 books, and you find one like this. Now, this book will make a program. This is what we spend our time doing here, is to generate information and then put it on the air. Now, it just happened that the lady talking to my wife the other day, asked about this thing of devaluation. My wife said, well, devaluation is where you're going to take your money in on Monday, $100, and you're going to get 50, maybe, if you're lucky. Maybe you'll get 10 back, and prices aren't going to change, so you're going to take it in the shorts. And she said, that's not fair. I wonder where this lady's been. I mean, hell, this has been going on for thousands of years. As long as people have been using unjust weights and balances, which is at least the last 4,000 years of recorded history, we've been using unjust weights and balances. And we have these boom and bust cycles. We have socialism and communism and Nazism and fascism, and hell, that's the rule. A free market economy that we experienced in the United States of America between 1787 and 1933 is a rare exception. That has been repeated in the history of the world maybe 5 or 6 times in all of recorded history. Has a nation or an empire, a civilization, had a free market economy? Now, we had one here in the United States, and it produced the wealthiest, most successful, most powerful military, political, and economic power that the world has ever seen. It happened in the Roman Empire, and it produced the wealthiest, most successful, most military, powerful nation and economic juggernaut in the ancient world. So the free market economy has been used several times in recorded history. And every time it's used, it produces, without exception, the wealthiest, most powerful political, economic, and military society or empire in the world at the time. It was tried in Egypt, and it worked like a shot. It was tried in Babylon, Assyria, the Greco-Macedonian Empire, the Roman Empire. It was tried here in the United States of America. It was tried in the British Empire. When the British people practiced this, free market economics, they became the wealthiest, most powerful empire in the history of the world. Now, what happens when these empires and nations become wealthy and successful and powerful? They become excessive in their greed, their lusts, their desires. And then they turn to socialism. They wanna get something for nothing. And they become lazy and indolent. And then over time they become weak. And then they go into national captivity. They're destroyed and they're just removed from the world scene. That's what happened to the Roman Empire, and that's what happened to the Greeks and Macedonians and the Egyptians and the Babylonians and so on. And it's what is in the process of happening to the Americans. It happened to you British people. Now, just because your empire collapses doesn't mean that the people cease to exist. You know, the Spanish people in the 15th, 16th, 17th century had a monumental empire, big, gigantic, you know, not world encompassing, but it encompassed, you know, South America and Mexico and much of the United States of America, California, you know, and Nevada and so on. But it collapsed. It disintegrated. And it was replaced by some other empire, some other nation or civilization comes along. And that's all we're going to see here. There's going to be a replacement. The Chinese will replace us, or the Russians, or somebody else. And then somebody else will be dictating the way the world is run, whether it's from Beijing, China, or Moscow, Russia, or London, England. Somebody like the Americans today in Washington, D.C., directs the world's course, the world's political course. It's coming to an end. Now, as a result of that, what we're witnessing over here, we ought to have some kind of an understanding as to why this is going on and why it's happening. So let's start off with a quick example here. Let's take Robinson Crusoe. Remember the story on Robinson Crusoe? That's a monumental story. Not only was it entertaining, but it's also very instructional. Robinson Crusoe, if you'll remember, is on a ship. And it runs aground, and everybody's killed except Robinson Crusoe. And he swims and swims, and he finally ends up on a deserted island. It's a big island, a pretty good-sized island. I think it was 10 miles long and 5 miles wide, about 50 square miles. It's a pretty good-sized piece of real estate. But here he is. He's washed up. Now, his first problem when he washes up on the beach is that he is cold, wet, and hungry. And he's the only guy on the island. So he can't go down to the local 7-Eleven. He can't go into Starbucks, you know, and get a hot latte, or into McDonald's, you know, and order a Big Mac and fries. He's on his own, and he can only consume as much as he produces. Because, think about it, he's the only guy there producing. And as the story goes on, he wakes up in the morning, he's cold and shivering, and so first of all he needs to build a fire to warm himself up and dry himself off, and now he needs some food, and so he's out scrounging around trying to, but he looks out here and he sees the ship, it's up here on the rocks. And so he starts going out to the ship to salvage stuff, and he salvages food, and he salvages guns and gunpowder, and he brings the stuff ashore. He's got a pretty good stash of stuff. He provides shelter for himself. He finds a cave, so that keeps him out of the rain. And he brings this stuff in, and this store of wealth that he brings off of the ship is his wealth. Now, he doesn't need a job. He has full employment. And what is his full employment? Subsistence and survival. His full-time life's profession is subsistence and survival. He is going to have to produce everything that he eats. He's going to have to produce everything that he's going to use. So he's very fortunate. He has an inheritance. He's going to inherit a lot of other people's labor. You see, the goods and the stores that are on the ship that he's salvaging off of the ship, he didn't produce any of that. The lumber and the planks that he salvages, somebody else, you know, some logger went up in the woods and cut the trees down. And some carpenter shaped them and made boards and built that ship. And he takes this ship apart and he salvages everything that he can. That's his wealth. So he doesn't need a paycheck every Friday. He doesn't need a bank. Doesn't need any insurance. He doesn't have life insurance. He doesn't have auto insurance. He doesn't have health and accident insurance. He doesn't have old age and survivor's benefits. He doesn't have unemployment insurance or workman's compensation. Doesn't need it. Isn't necessary. And so in his economy, now he's in an economy. Every one of us is an economist. I'm an economist. You're an economist. The policeman's an economist. Everybody's concerned about economy. Economy. What we're really dealing with here in the economy is the production and the distribution of our wealth. It's the production and distribution of what we create and produce. It's our wealth. Now, he climbs trees and he throws coconuts down and he gathers in food and he plants a garden and he raises things and he found seeds on the boat, and he starts off with a pretty good store of wealth. Unlike Adam and Eve, you know, it started out in the garden. I mean, they had plenty of food there. Remember, they got kicked out. All of a sudden, they lost all their wealth. This easy food that they had to just pick off the trees. Now they got to go out and plant their own trees, and they got to go out and they got to scramble now. So Robinson Crusoe then is a subsistence farmer. He's a subsistence producer. He can go out and catch fish. Now he can go out and spend his time catching fish. And if all he does is fish, then he's not going to have any coconuts. So he has to divide his time up so that some of the time he's fishing, and some of the time he's gathering coconuts, and some of the time he's gathering pineapples, and some of the time he's working in his garden, and some of the time he's building a house. And so, but he has to do it all. All right, now let's take this a step further. Remember the story about Swiss Family Robinson? There's a case where a family is shipwrecked. Very similar to Robinson Crusoe, except that instead of just one person taking care of himself, it's a whole family. So we got six people here. We've got, it's five or six, I forgot how many was in the family, but they've got four children, I think it was, and mom and dad. And so they need to salvage what they can, and each one has a division of labor. And so while one of them's cutting firewood, another one is working building their treehouse, and another is working here and there, or three or four of them can work together. So we have a family economy. But here again, think about it. These people have it easier because you've got four or five people to lift these heavy beams around. I mean, I'm a carpenter, and I can build a house by myself, but I can tell you, I can build a house in about one-tenth to one-fourth of the time if I've got one guy helping me. Boy, you think about trying to put up roof rafters, by yourself. Now, it can be done. You can build by yourself, but boy, it's kind of slow. But if you've got one other guy, just if nothing else, just to hold the end of it for you. Just to light your cigarettes and pour your coffee is a help. So we call those helpers. So the Swiss Family Robinson people, they got right into the program. They had a division of labor, but it was just one family. So they didn't need auto insurance. They didn't need workman's compensation or old age and survivor's benefits. They didn't need what we term, in a modern economy today, we think about Social Security as being a must. We got to have it. All right. So now, if you'll think about these two cases, this is Swiss Family Robinson and Robinson Crusoe. These people are subsistence farmers, and they're operating in an economy. They cannot consume more than they produce. But in the case of Swiss Family Robinson, remember, one of the kids is just a little guy, and he can't produce very much. He depends in his consumption upon the production of other members of the society, other members of the family. So he does a little work. He does a little. He does. He takes out the garbage, and he helps mom in the kitchen, and he does little things, around the house. But he's not a full-fledged producer yet. He's actually a consumer. And as time progresses along, as he gets older, as he gets bigger, and he's more able and physically stronger, then he becomes a productive member of society, a productive member, a taxpayer, we call him today. He gets out there and he works and produces and pulls his weight. So in an organized society like the United States of America, all we're really dealing with here is a lot of families working together, like Swiss Family Robinson. And all of these families working together with the division of labor produce this great variety. You walk into a Walmart store and they advertise, "We have 10,000 products on our shelves." Hey, listen, when you're on a desert island, you're not going to have 10,000 products to choose from. See, you're not going to have things, like a 3/8 bolt with SAE thread, with nuts, lock washers, and flat washers. I mean, come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. So you're going to be using vines, and maybe you're going to be twisting these vines together and maybe tying these together. In primitive societies, they have houses. Yeah, they have houses. And they have thatched roofs. They don't have Johns Manville roofing shingles produced, at the Johns Manville plant, made out of tar that comes from the production of oil, that's shipped over here from Saudi Arabia and comes out of an oil refinery. I mean, come on. Now, the reason that we have all of these products, all of these inventions, and all these great things that make life now in our modern technological world, our society, with our computers and bank accounts and checking accounts and Social Security and insurance policies and policemen, working their beats and firemen to come out and put your fire. When Robinson Crusoe builds his house and it catches on fire, guess where the fire department is? Guess who's going to put the fire out? When Robinson Crusoe, has these cannibals coming onto the island and, eating people on the island, a little later on he comes up with his man Friday, remember? He saved Friday from being eaten. Hey, he's his own policeman. He's got to go out here and defend himself. He doesn't call 911. When there's cannibals on the island, he has to pick up his musket and go out there and play vigilante. There's no 911, there's no police coming out here. So, that's economy. And it derives from this simple economy. And that's where I wanted to start this story, because that's where Hazlitt starts. He starts the story here with a broken window. Broken window. Listen to this. Let's begin with the simplest illustration possible. Let us, emulating Bastiat, or Bastiat, choose a broken pane of glass. A young hoodlum, let's say, heaves a brick through a window in a baker's shop, and the shopkeeper runs out furious. But the boy runs away. Now a crowd gathers and begins to stare with quiet satisfaction at the gaping hole in the window and the shattered glass all over the bread and pies. So after a while, the crowd feels the need for philosophic reflection, and several of the members in the crowd are almost certain to remind each other and the baker that, after all, this misfortune has its bright side, because it's going to make business for the glazer. And as they begin to think about this, they elaborate upon it. How much does a new plate glass window cost? Well, it's going to cost about $250. And that'll be quite a sum. After all, if windows were never broken, what would happen to the glass business? Now, that's a pretty good question. You know, what would happen to the glazer over here if we didn't have broken windows? Then, of course, if we continue this on, it's endless. You know, the glazer will have $250 more to spend, and he'll be spending that money with the other merchants. And those merchants, in turn, will have $250 more to spend with still other merchants, and so on ad infinitum. The smashed window will go on providing money and employment in an ever-widening circle. The local and logical conclusion from all of this would be, if the crowd drew that conclusion, that the little hoodlum who threw the brick and broke the window, far from being a public menace, was actually a public benefactor. Look at how he has expanded the economy. So let's take another look. The crowd is at least right in its first conclusion. This little act of vandalism is, in fact, in the first instance, going to mean more business for some glazer. Now, the glazers will be no more unhappy to learn of this incident than an undertaker in learning of somebody dying. But the shopkeeper will be out $250 that he was planning to spend on a new suit. And because of this, he had to replace the window. He will have to go without the suit. So instead of having a window and $250, he now has a window. And he doesn't have the suit, and he doesn't have the $250. So the baker has lost the suit and $250. The glazer now has the $250. He's happy. Now, as he was planning to buy that suit that very afternoon, instead of having both a window and a suit, he must be content now with the window and no suit and no money. If we think of him as a part of the community has lost a new suit that might otherwise have come into being and is just that much poorer. Because what the baker wanted to do was to take the $250 over to the tailor and spend it with the tailor. The tailor would have then taken the fabric and created a new suit. He would have created new wealth. That's how new wealth comes into existence. Then we would have the window, the suit, and we would have the $250. The tailor would have the $250 instead of the glazer. We would have the window, and we would have the suit. Everybody would have been $250 wealthier in the community, because now we would have the suit, the money, and we would have the glass. But because we broke the glass, we destroyed a part of our wealth, and we had to replace the glass and do away with the suit. Do you think that by destroying windows, we can produce more wealth, that we can become richer? If you think so, why don't you take a rock and throw it through your front window? And let's talk about how much wealth you've produced next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. But since I'm running out of time, I have to remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review that were sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. That's the signal. It says our time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing. So until then, thanks for listening and good night, friends.